Welcome to Shakespeare and Company. Tonight's event is a little bittersweet. Sweet because, well, it's a Freeman's event. And a Freeman's event not only means a panel of extraordinary guests, just look at tonight, Yakuta, Deborah, and Juan Gabriel, but it also means superb and surprising conversation teased out by John Freeman's compelling and compassionate chairing. Bitter because, well, it's a Freeman's event. And as I'm sure you all know, the current issue of Freeman's will be the last. Quite right. After more than 8 years and over 500 live events, including many here, it's time to bid the good ship Freeman's bon voyage. The end of Freeman's is an incalculable loss to the literary landscape. I can think of no other literary magazine as engaging, as democratic, and as personable as Freeman's, mainly because I can think of no other editor as engaging, as democratic, and as personable as John. He'll be back here, of course, as publisher for Knopf, as author and poet, and also as all-round promoter of good writing and fine books. Still, it's with a certain sadness and a certain pride, sadness because it's the end, pride because we were along for the journey, that I ask you to please join me in welcoming to Shakespeare and Company our final Freeman's panel, Yakuta Elikavezovic, Deborah Landau, Juan Gabriel Vasquez, and of course, John Freeman.
Thank you, Adam. I don't normally approach the microphone that way. I'm so happy to be here for the last event. The part of having a magazine, it's not about, I think, curating reputations. It's not about the rise and fall of literary fights. It's really an excuse to get people together in a room and have interesting conversations. And if that room is metaphorical and is in the pages of a book, like a magazine, then I think lots of things are possible. And I'm especially happy tonight because here are three writers that I love dearly for different reasons, but have spent not nearly as much time with them as I love them. And that includes Deborah Landau, who I used to work for as the NYU professor, but I interact with not nearly enough as a poet and as a reader of her work, of her five collections, including Skeletons, which is just out and was one of the New Yorker's best books of poetry of last year. Juan Gabriel and I have just finally met, I think, for the first time in person, and he wrote a piece in the Home issue. Many of you will know him as the author of many novels, including The Informers, the winner of the Impact Prize, as well as books of essays, a biography of Conrad. He's also written Poems, which came out last year. In 2022, and last year he published two books in Spanish. And so my hope is that there's a lot more of him to come. And in his novels and in his work, I feel an intense combustion of what's possible in the space of a novel, and that the novel is a political and personal and emotional form par excellence, and that the so-called Latin American boom, which supposedly ended in the 80s, has been carried forward many times over in his work. And finally, Yakuta and I recently crossed paths in Sarajevo, a part of the world from which her family comes. She was born here in Paris in 1979, for those of you who don't know her, is the author of several novels, a wonderful book about being in the Louvre overnight, which won the Prix Medici d'Essai. She also won the Prix something for first novel. She's a translator among the people that she brings into French, include David Foster Wallace, Ben Lerner, Anna Burns, an amazing list. Also, Juan Gabriel is a translator and has translated many books, including among them Hiroshima by John Hershey. There's a lot of overlap here tonight. There's two people who write short stories. There's two poets. There's two people who have had literary columns. There's a lot of Gen Xers. We're all from that generation that's feeling a little bit overlooked now. And we're also just coming to you now at the start of a year. And one of the most important panels I think I ever got to have here, thanks to Sylvia and David and Adam, was a panel at the start of the Trump presidency. With ZZ Packer and Nathan Engliner and Alexander Hemen, in which everyone basically funneled fear and prognostications about what was about to happen through their particular anxiety optic. And Nathan's was like, they're always coming for us. I'm going to keep my head down. Sasha was like, fascism never really left Europe. And Zizi said, it's never been great for black people. And we had that conversation and then updated it. And so I feel we're at a different point now. We're at a very different point because some of the conditions we were talking about in that conversation are now fully globalized. They have always been, but some of the obviousness of it is apparent. Before I get to that, though, I want to start just a little bit of a step back and just looking at what writers do. They tell stories. They make art. They make shapes. They make patterns. And so because this is a conclusions issue, I want to start with a really just basic question is, how do you know when the story starts? How do you know where to start the story? And I guess I want to start with you, Juan, because you used to live in Paris. You lived here, and you actually stayed in this very space 27 years ago.
Yes.
So there is some personal orbiting that's happening as well. What kind of thoughts do you have now about how a story begins and where you place the beginning, and what that means politically and emotionally?
Yeah, well, thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be here at this. I don't know if that we need it. Do we need it?
We're recording.
Oh, okay, so we need it. I'm sorry.
I don't know if it's on.
Yeah. Yes, it's on. Okay. Well, thank you all for being here. It's a pleasure to be here at Shakespeare & Company. I did stay here so many years ago when I was a young South American trying to be a writer in Paris, which is like a walking cliche. But I did that, and so many things have changed since then. Not only because I've published novels, but because I've changed. The world has changed around us as readers of literature. Where does a story begin? I think it begins with a question. I think there are two kinds of writers, basically. Those who write because they don't know, and those who write to explain something that they've already learned. A great Spanish novelist, Javier Marías, that you have maybe read. If you haven't, please go and find his work. Javier Marías used to say that there are two kinds of novelists, those who work with a compass and those who work with a map. So if you have a map, you already know what you're going to find on the road. Every mountain, every turn of the road, every river is there for you to foresee. But if you work with a compass, you know that you're going north and you have absolutely no idea what you will find on the road. I work with a compass. I begin a novel because there's a question, there's a mystery, there's a secret that I find needs the very particular tools of fiction for me to try to understand it, to come up with something resembling an answer which you never get to. But the pleasure and the illumination is in the question, in asking the question. I always remember this letter that this critic, Alexei Suvorin, sent Chekhov, telling him, you know, the thing with your stories is that you don't take a stance, you don't take a moral stance, we don't know what you think politically. And Chekhov answered saying, you are confusing two things, answering the questions and identifying them correctly. Only the latter is required of an author. This is what we do. We don't give you the answers, mainly because we don't know them ourselves. We try to identify the correct questions, the questions that are more worthy of a certain exploration that literature can do. So that's the point where we set out from, and then we try to see what happens.
The piece that Javier, that Juan wrote for the Freemans, I was mistaking you from Javier Marías.
You're allowed to do that.
not Javier Montes or any other Javier, but Marías, this amazing piece, which I will challenge you to summarize, but in it involved Paris, your mother. Your mother-in-law,
yes.
And some famous literary figures, and a television?
Yes.
And the
VCR even.
And a VCR and the sort of element of chance, because when you start out with a compass, it at least presumes that there's a territory that can be known. But when chance enters the map of fiction or storytelling, it turns storytelling three-dimensional, because it suggests that no matter how much you start out thinking you can know what is knowable, there is some other element that determines events which cannot be predicted or even named.
Yes, well, I mean, the ingredient of surprise, I think, is something without which I couldn't be a writer. I mean, the idea, I write op-eds, as you know, I write political columns, and I think those two ethics, to put it that way, are as opposed as they can be. When you write as a novelist, you write because you don't know, you write because you want to find out, you write out of ignorance and uncertainty. As in political commentary, you write because you think, you know, you have the illusion of conviction about something, the illusion of certainty. At least that's how I see it. And there are no two more different ways of being in the world than those of a political commentator and a novelist. Mm. Actually, the idea of a novelist is a very strange thing. Somebody who is trying to make you care about things that have never happened to people that had never existed, not trying to find a definite answer about anything, but rather trying to convince you that in the exploration of often opposed ideas, there is some kind of knowledge to be earned. It's a very strange métier, and it really amazes me that people still read novels, and gives me hope. Gives me hope too.
Yakuta, your piece is Juan's was also a column. Mm-hmm. It was published in Libération in French, and we and Damien Searles did a beautiful translation of it. And it also involves a kind of it's not chance, but it's using the oddness of language to sort of open up something that seemed prematurely predetermined. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that as a model for an essay, because we live so much in polemic times that the essay seems like it's instrumentalized to be a delivery mechanism for an already agreed upon point, and that does not seem at all like the kind of essay you write.
No, and that's not the kind of essays I wanted to write. And good evening, everyone. I'm so happy to be here. This is me taking time to think. I wanted the essays. I've had the column in Libération for, I think, 5 years now, and time does fly. And I started out, I actually wanted to say no when they asked me, when they invited me. And then I ended up saying yes, which is sort of high work and high process things. And the reason I wanted to say no is exactly what you mentioned, is the idea that I would be rehashing something that was obvious to me and that would be reader-friendly, Libération-friendly in a way, and that we'd be entre nous, amongst kindred souls and kindred readership, and that the literary challenge I could not see. And then I sort of flipped the no into a yes, and I flipped the argument for myself, thinking, well, what if you take this opportunity and try to find a new form, essays that ask questions instead of providing answers to unasked questions or questions that have been asked so much that, you know, we know the rote answers to them. A column is a very set space. It's a page, basically. It's always like, I know Americans think in terms of words. We think in terms of caractère, espace compris. So it's not the same, but it's always the same length. It's always the same pattern, really. And what I wanted to do, and it became obvious as I wrote for the newspaper, is, you know, provide a sidestep, like, you know, something you're used to seeing in a certain light. Just change the light, change the focus, change the point of view on it. And most of the time, I find great joy in dealing with everyday things, everyday. Taking an anecdote, something that happened to me or that could have happened to me, and sort of try and unravel it. And it's almost, it's a column for Libération, so it's supposed to be extremely grounded, and in a way it is. In another way, it's very speculative. In another way, I almost breach it, and I get the feeling I'm writing science fiction, except everything is real.
I want to, without meaning to, both of you are sort of refuting the epistemology of the world in which we live, in which everyone is marked by data points and IP addresses, the modes in which we gather information, especially if you're reading online, are fed by algorithms which are intending to give you more of what you've already not even clicked on, but sometimes hovered your cursor on or even had your eyeball look at for a while. And so you should look into the metadata that corporations have, even publishers. We can tell what supermarket aisle you stopped in and for how long. And so as a result, the ideas of chance and interaction become incredibly important on a philosophical and experiential and political level. And you know, I was always struck by when reading poorly French newspapers with my poor French, how regimented in certain thought structures the critical landscape is. You know, I was here one year when a big novel came out, and I had read a review poorly, and someone said, "Oh, that's the Marxist critic. He never would like that." And I thought, well, then why did he review it? And so I wonder if you can just say a little bit more about working in the French context in that mode, because I keep hearing from Sideways and my own bad experience that it seems to be somewhat predetermined, not just because of the internet and the way we read, but how idealistically people are balkanized in senses.
John, have you invited me to do some French bashing tonight?
I have, in the heart of France.
No, I will not indulge. the French way of thinking and hence writing is extremely structured. It's extremely formal in a way, and life is a formal thing, so it's a good thing. And I was schooled that way. I was educated with a strong sense of structure, of argument, of development, and it did wonders for me. And it's because I know how to do that that I was at liberty to sort of move into more impressionistic way of looking at things. But underlying, I have a very strong belief and trust in the intellectual structures at work within the French mind and the French way of writing. Then I'm sure that would strike you as an American reading French newspapers, and you'd probably, the first thing you'd zone in and zoom in and identify would be the structures, the bone structure of a piece, for instance. And it's true, you could argue, there's an argument to be made that it's always the same, but it's the same because a face is always the same. You have usually two eyes and a nose and cheekbones and a chin. But then the variety there is extremely rich. So I'm not advocating for the French way of writing. I'm not doing that either, because I'm trying, and I've been trying, to sort of step away from that and free myself from the weight of structure. But there's a point to be made in defense of the structure and of French Marxist writers.
I have nothing against Marxists. In fact, I kind of largely agree. But I think this has been very much on my mind, in the sense that we are living through a time in which the simple observation. I mentioned Hiroshima, and that was a book that had such an enormous impact on people's impressions of nuclear power and its destruction and its immense cruelty, that the U.S. government had to get someone to write a rebuttal in Harper's, basically saying, you know, it's not quite so. And we're living now in an era where I think a lot of our news structures are not providing nearly as much as we need to know. And so the power, the enchanting power of fiction, the scrambling power of the impressionistic essay, and the piercing power of a poem becomes ever more important in order to function ethically, soundly, with sanity as a civilian, as a person who needs to make decisions large and small. And, you know, Deborah, we've been talking about craft as a kind of way of not packaging experience, but shaping it and making a before and beginning. And I'm curious, because your new book, Skeletons, which follows Soft Targets, it begins, figuratively at the end of life, when supposedly life ends. And yet you make Skeletons into this incredibly gesturally powerful device within your book, and it's emotional, it's erotic, it's physical, it's familial. It's a way of thinking about vulnerability and the pandemic. And I'm just curious what you think about beginnings and where a poem starts and what it brings to the reader when it starts to make a shape of a time period.
First of all, thank you for having me, and it's so wonderful to be in this cozy new space up here and to be at Shakespeare with all of you. I love the figure of the compass or the map, and I would say that typically for me a poem has always begun compass style. Like, I would have an agitation, I would just have a feeling and try to find the language for it. But this last book, which is over here, Skeletons, I started writing in March 2020, locked down in Brooklyn in a room with four people and a dog. And I thought, I'll never write anything again, so I needed a map. And the map was something that I always thought was silly, which was the acrostic form, which is like, you know, you think of it as like a kind of a poem you would write when you're in third grade or something. Like, it says the word skeleton down the left-hand side. And so, but there was tremendous freedom with that, actually. Those bones, it was a trick that helped me to write a whole book. And by assembling like a pile of S words, a pile of K words, and then you just write from, and then you line them up and you write from one to the next, and that kind of play, that kind of freedom. And I was able to make something despite all the sirens going by. I know what a terrible time that was. And
We've been talking a little bit about writers that you know are elevated through the translation work to some degree of Juan and Yakuta, and both of the people I know that you've translated have an intense sort of linguistic density. Anna Burns and Foster Wallace, not to mention Ben Lerner, and I know there are others. Deborah, when you just mentioned the Skeletons as a kind of scaffolding, but when it comes to conclusions, I feel like one of the conclusions I've come to recently is that style is in its own way a conclusion, you know. And I hesitate to characterize your style back to you in front of you, because that
he's so good at that.
but there's an eerie sensuality in your style that's beckoning, but is also somewhat haunting, and it's laced through by all kinds of kind of elements of the Gothic, if you will. It's in all your books, I think. And I wonder, you know, once we get to a certain stage, we're all in our 50s or about close, you know, you're not there, but we're all, the rest of us are in, it'll be warm when you get in. do you think of style as a kind of conclusion that you're working towards, that like, that you now sound like yourself more so than you did, say, in your first book or two?
Oh, that's a nice way of thinking of it. I don't know. I think each book is the self you were at that time, and the self is always shifting, actually. Conclusions. I'm not good at those. I mean, there's one conclusion we're heading toward. Someone once said to me, you know, you should end a poem on an image and not explain it. So I've always liked that. Like, life doesn't have to work against the kind of epiphany or the closure in an ending, because life doesn't typically have that, you know, big wrap-up ending, to work toward dissonance or something that's, yes, haunting or eerie. That feels more like life to me. And then I've written lots of long sequences trying to kind of postpone that ending. And then with this book, the ending had to start with the letter N, that last line. So that was helpful.
That book was written partly like Soft Targets here in Paris, And you know, you've written in Paris, and you live here. And I'm curious about how much spaces draw you to certain conclusions. I grew up in Sacramento, and one of my conclusions was get the hell out. And then I came back, and I thought, oh, it's so nice. These trees are really good. One of the things, Paris, the wheel of the city, it sort of sends you out, but it kind of brings you back in. And there's a whole, we could have a whole separate conversation about the psychogeography of the conclusions a city leads you to. But I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, Deborah or Juan, you know, about the way that a particular place, but particularly this place, what kind of conclusions about life it makes possible.
Well, this place in particular has always been a fetish for me in a very strange sense. When I went to law school, I got my diploma as a lawyer. By the time that happened, I had already spent 2 years, 3 years, knowing that I did not want to become a lawyer, that I wanted to become a novelist, that this was the only thing that interested me in life was to try to learn how to read and write novels. And the two generations that had put that idea in my head, the two generations that had shaped my sensibility, my idea of what prose fiction does, were the Latin American boom and the Lost Generation, and basically the people who lived in Paris but wrote in English between wars. So Joyce, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and the people they brought into my worldview, Virginia Woolf, Faulkner, and then the Latin American boom, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, Julio Cortázar, Argentinian writer who lived here almost all his life, the poets, Octavio Paz, who used to say that if popes are made in Rome, literature Nobel Prizes are made in Paris. And this is not why I came here. Please. But this made Paris a city that meant something for me in particular when I arrived here in 96 for the first time to stay for 3 years. I ended up hating Paris in 99. And then some years later, I fell in love back with Paris, and that has never left. It's still a magical place for me. It has a relationship with the written word that I value. I'm as much a Francophile as I love my own culture and English language culture. And French literature has shaped my outlook. And my idea, too, this is something that doesn't exist quite as much in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, in what we call the Anglo-Saxon tradition, the idea of the novelist also as a public intellectual. And this is something that has fallen on me, and it's a tradition that I like, actually. I have a relationship with the city that goes through language, through words, through the history of literature, and that doesn't resemble the relationship that I have with other cities. Hmm.
As someone born and raised here, Yakut, how does the idea of being a writer in Paris, if it's at all, or how does this, if this doesn't make sense to you, how does the city draw you to certain conclusions about your role as a writer? And I'm talking of the city as a kind of organism, mm-hmm. As much as the city as a history, as a city as a living text.
Well, you know, John, I was born here, as I think you mentioned, and but I was born in a dream. I was born in the city my parents dreamed of, and that they came and settled in. First, my mother and then my father came from the former Yugoslavia and fell in love with Paris. First, my mom and then my dad, and so I'm the child of a conclusion in a way, because I'm what comes after Happily Ever After. So the burden now is, and I think that actually has informed and shaped my relationship to endings. I never take an ending at face value. something's ending, something has ended, but then it's our job as writers, as intellectuals, but most of all as human beings, it's our job to imagine and to dream up what comes after the end. Because we want to live on, we want to endure, we want to have dreams of our own, and we want to make them real. And so in my family, it's a generational thing. My parents dreamt of Paris. I was born here. I lived the life. And I became this dream figure, the French or French-ish writer. But then that comes with, you know, a whole new set of realistic needs and rules and things I have to imagine now. What happens after, you know, after you become what people have probably dreamt of becoming or have dreamt for you to become? What then? How do you live that life? Mm. So that's the job. That's what I'm supposed to be and write about.
Deborah, did you have any dreams of Paris when you were growing up in Michigan?
Yes. I had dreams of never going back to Michigan or getting out of Michigan. I like to live in cities. I like to write in cities, New York, and especially Paris. I remember coming up from the metro for the first time and seeing the city, the lights, this bookshop, coming here like everyone and buying A Movable Feast, falling in love with it, and not knowing, like, I was young. Like, years later, starting 2007, bringing writers to Paris 6 weeks a year as part of our, I don't know if everyone knows, I run programs for New York University in Paris. And so bringing writers here over the years, bringing faculty, and to see what Paris does to people's work. I mean, of course, it's a feast for the senses, as we say, and the simultaneity of all these different lives happening in a relatively small place, all the history. And it's been thrilling to watch Paris show up in people's books, the faculty's books, to see our students kind of enlivened by being here. And I was just saying, I think, to David beforehand, I never get tired of it. Hmm. It's so...
Yeah, no, it is a real thing. And I mean, we're talking about the difference between having a dream and being a dream to some degree. And sometimes they overlap to some degree. And, you know, sometimes you have to rewrite the dream. And I feel like one of the things that, Juan, you do in your book is trying to figure out a way to carry forward a tradition that matters to you, but to reset the stakes of it. Yes. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because you've written and set books in Florence and Bogota, obviously, and you've written about murders, and you've written about political cartoonists, and there's been you have quite a wide range of what goes into your books. But there, if I had to say one thing that to me unites them is that there is in each book an attempt to form a collective in a different format, and you're looking at threats to the collective, whether it's murder, whether it's just getting an issue done in time. Yeah. You know, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about carrying forward a dream that, you know, it wasn't as nice. Haldor Laxness, not Latin American, obviously, he came here, he was broke, he starved. You know, you see all these plaques about people who came and wrote here. Some of them were deeply lonely. Some were suicidally lonely. Some today would have been kicked out of Macron's Paris in a second. Yeah. And I wonder, you know, how do you hold on to the parts of the tradition you love? You know, that is way more than sort of the Pleiad edition of The Lost Generation. Mm. And so what things are you driven to demolish in order to make space for the new dream that you want to be part of or that you want to write towards or become?
Yeah. Well, the experience of Paris was never as good for every major Latin American writer. García Márquez hated it when he stayed here. He used to be... confused by the police with Algerian terrorists, and so he was put in jail. And whereas for Mario Vargas Llosa, he only talks about the experience of meeting from a distance Albert Camus, so there were very different experiences. What I find sometimes that I'm trying to do in my books, to go to the center of your question, is to illuminate that crossroads between public and private lives. I mean, to illuminate that place where the private life of individuals is shaped by forces that are public in nature, history and politics. The moment in which those forces, that the monster of history and politics, invades your private life and changes the way you behave as a brother, as a sister, as a son or a daughter, as a lover, as a husband, as a wife, this is what interests me. This is what I try to do. And I find in that sense I'm trying to recover a little of the intimacy that was lost in the literature of the Latin American boom, because one of their main tasks was to rewrite public history in South America. They realized that Latin American history lies. It lies all the time. It used to lie, particularly in a particularly strong way when they were writing, because the country was invaded by military dictatorships from north to south. These dictatorships have changed political sign over time, but they have never stopped trying to impose a certain kind of narrative on society. And there is then this idea that I really believe in, that in countries such as ours, one of the possible justifications of literature, if it needs any, is to contradict the official version that is being given by that thing we call power, with a capital P. Literature is always the little annoying creature raising its head and saying things did not happen that way, or you are forgetting something else, or you are trying to hide a kind of truth. It's the way citizens recover the right to tell their own story. And this is what I have been trying to do in all my novels. This is the only thing they have in common, probably. To try to fill up or illuminate the little silences left by official history in our countries, or the lies that official history is telling.
Yakuta, do you relate to that at all? I mean, you're the country that you come from doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. The crossroads of the personal and the collective, and how one is deeply, profoundly shaped by extraneous forces. Yes, of course, that's what literature at heart is about. It's a personal, deeply personal experience that somehow reaches a collective form of significance. So it's sort of la réponse du berger à la bergère, we say in French. The answer of the shepherdess to the shepherd. Power makes you do this or does this to you. Well, literature has a say in that. It's the annoying footnote. It's the little gremlin. It's always there to remind you, you know, yes, but. What if? Let's try and see things in another way. And that way, literature is always about open endings, in a way. That's why I keep having hope for literature. I have more hope for literature than I have for mankind, if I have to be honest. But yes, of course, as long as there will be injustice and people seeing the injustice, feeling the injustice, literature will find a way into the situation. And that way it's like water. It finds a way. It sort of seeps into it. And literature, even in its most modest form, it could be a writing on a wall someplace. It could be a tweet that will go viral. And there's no saying the layering of significance and meaning that these words, simple in appearance, may take.
I just wanted to add that I always come back to Wallace Stevens, who said that poetry is a violence from within that protects us from a violence from without, the imagination pressing back against the pressure of reality.
That was someone sitting at an insurance office. Imagine if he was writing today. I want to ask a final question of Juan and Yakuta in particular, in part because you've translated Hiroshima, and that had such a I think one of the things I've been thinking about, and it keeps me up at night, is the ability for images and information to be able to change and reach us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot about, there was someone at the party the other day, Adam, who looked just like Susan Sontag and had the stripe in her hair too. Do you know this person? Thank you for hiring the Susan Sontag double, whoever that was. But it made me think about how she wrote on photography, and then she, after going to Sarajevo, she changed her mind. And you know, on photography has quite a dismal view of what photography can do to you empathically. And then she went to Sarajevo, the longest modern siege in history, and in spite of the evidence of what was happening around, came to a more hopeful conclusion. But images that were of the siege of Sarajevo and the violence done to human bodies during that siege was not frequently shown on U.S. media. And I'm not going to go into a long rant about the imperiling ethical demise of U.S. media, but I do think, you know, would a book like Hiroshima be possible today? Obviously, that was the first and only use of the most destructive weapon humankind has ever created. But what would a book like that, what kind of act of witness? I think about Night, for example, too, by Elie Wiesel. I can still remember the bed in the East Village I was in, reading that at age 21 as an editorial assistant, and I thought, how have I not read this book before? And I have that feeling sometimes when I watch the news on Al Jazeera, and I think, how have I not ever seen this image before? So is there some kind of version of that act of witness that, beyond what you just described as the novel bringing the macro down to a human level and recorrecting to some degree the derangements of acts of violence upon the record of history, is there some act of witness that can kind of, that is beyond that act in non-fictional form that needs to happen, that can happen today?
I think it's a very good question, and I don't have an answer except to say that this is what literature has always done. This kind of descent. This is something Camus wrote about in The Rebel. He said there's the time of literature of consentment, and then there's a time of literature of descent. Literature in which always the written word is about trying to sound the contradictory notes, trying to say, no, it's not like that, trying to be the party spoiler, mm-hmm. right? Hiroshima was, in a way, the party spoiler. In a time, as a document, you cannot go more against the national grain than it did. It was almost risky to publish that story. The other book that I have, I'm very proud of, the first book that I ever translated, which was Hiroshima, and the last book that I translated, which was Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad. And that's also, it's a book that is not popular right now. It's heavily questioned for many reasons that are very interesting to discuss. We don't have time to do that now. But it's also a very, a deeply felt act of dissent. It's a book that says, I'm not going along with this, with the common opinion of, for instance, what colonialism is. And it's always happening. It's almost in the DNA of literature to keep doing that. And if I can't think of any titles that are doing exactly that right now, I know they're there, and I know they will come up. But the thing is, I also believe that literature is going, in particular novels, are being kind of pushed to the margins of our society as tools of knowledge. I believe in fiction as a tool for knowledge. We know certain things that we didn't know before, even if the knowledge is ambiguous, even if it doesn't import clear answers or clear truths, it is a kind of knowledge. Despite that, I think it's being pushed to the margins of society, and there are other dictions, other ways of talking about reality that have taken center stage, and some of them, in particular social media, are really repellent to me, are changing our conversation for the worse in almost any case, and depriving us of many useful attitudes towards life that are necessary to go to the bottom of it, of what's going on, of a difficult situation, or a contradictory situation, or an ambiguous situation that we're watching. It's almost as if social media and creative writing were at odds, diametrically opposed to each other. And I don't know that creative writing is winning.
Mm. I'm going to leave the last word for Yakuta, and then if anyone has a question, I encourage you to ask it in the brief amount of time we have. Adam will give us a nod when it's time to bail. But I love that category of literature of dissent versus literature of resistance. You know, what's that? Of consent and consent. Yeah, of consent and what's the opposite? Because the opposite of a literature of consent can be just simply refusing certain tropes of what is pre-agreed upon to be reality. Yes. And I spent a very unhappy 45 minutes at the Foundation Louis Vuitton today, looking at all those looking at all those Rothkos with 2,750 other people in the room. And I love Rothko, and the scope of the exhibit was almost industrial. As in addition to the number of people there. And it was, at some point there was a text that said he started doing this due to the horrors of reality. Like he left the figure. And I thought that makes a certain amount of sense. But I thought, would I even be able to identify what the sort of opposite of consent would be in literature of that kind of motion, you know, to veer away from. And I wonder if you, as a heavy reader, as a translator, as a novelist yourself, if you have any thoughts about what that kind of the opposite of consent looks like or feels like in literature today to you.
Yeah, I have an idea, but I don't know if you'll... okay, bear with me. I think that the answer is style in the end. I think that the one thing that stands against consent and conformity in literature is style. I think that whatever we need to know about the evil humankind is capable of, we know. The whole thing is, it's pretty much what you were saying about data mining and the way algorithms will know what you pause to look at. They know what you want to look at even if you decide not to look at it, even if your moral self thinks higher of you than, you know, your whatever other self, your social media self does. And I think that the key to that is style, because style, a certain slant of sentence, a certain music to words, a certain rhythm to a sentence as well, or to a paragraph, or to a whole novel, is what makes you want to engage. It creates something that's extraordinarily paradoxical, because it's a safe space, and it's everything but safe. You're exposed directly to the world, and yet you're safe. Isn't that incredible? And style, in the end, is what will make your heart beat, is what will make you read on, stay on, and wonder about what you've just read. I think that's the key. And I think that's something that cannot be replaced or displaced so easily. It's also something that you have to be educated in a way in order to be sensitive to. And that's one of my concerns, if we have to finish on a heftier note. One of my concerns is about, like, how do you teach the wonders and joys of reading? Because it's all about reading. It's all about the way you will pause and allow yourself to just be there in the presence of a voice, in the presence of someone who is absent. Isn't that dissent? Like, I refuse reality as it is, and I will spend time with someone who does not exist, as you so aptly said, or someone who has long been dead. I will pause the course of things, and there's this other space that sort of enlarges reality as we know it, that at least has this potential. And when I was younger, I often had this dream that I would discover a hidden room in my apartment. I would just open a pusher, especially when I was a student and living in very cramped spaces. And I would just push open a door, And that would be so much sunlight, so much space, so much warmth. Incredible. It's all been there for me, just waiting for me. That's what literature can and will do for me, for us, for anyone who has properly been introduced to it. And that's the thing that has to be, I think, and passed on.
Oh, my God, I can't think of a better way to let people loose in a room full of books that they can actually take home with them. Does anybody have a question for Deborah or Juan or Yakuta?
Can I ask you a question, John? Sorry. This is the final event, the final Freeman's. And I remember when you started it, and it was just extraordinary to watch you build it up into this, you know, lively, diverse collection of literature. How does it feel that it's ending? Like, how does it? What does the conclusion like feel like for you?
I think I feel like what a, and I don't present this metaphor entirely with a lot of thought, so forgive me if it sounds lame, but I think I feel a little bit like one of those booster rockets after the rocket keeps going, because I think if anything. If anything, the whole purpose of a magazine like mine has been to sort of bring readers to writers they may not have read before. So I suspect some of you know Yakuta, some of you know Juan, some of you know Deborah, some of you might know two of them. I suspect the number of who know all three is small, even in a room as literate and well-read as this. And so to me, the whole point of the magazine was to pass along passion for writers who do things with style and energy and their engagement with forms that made me happy, even if what they were writing about was included dark things. And so it feels like you cannot have a perpetually rising rocket. Eventually you leave the atmosphere. And you know, I do think magazines have a kind of shelf life. You know, otherwise they become kind of museums and of reputations, and you have that font that means like you've been stamped with the literary seal of approval because you're in such and such journal. I didn't want to ever be like that. I wanted it to be something that felt like as personal and human. That's why my name's on it, as alive, as a person, saying you have to read this person, you have to read this person, you have to read this person. So, you know. In that sense, I will miss that aspect. But there will be other journals that will come along and maybe have Adam here to introduce them. Or the next Adam's mini-me who will have a little red beard. Anything else before? Deborah's book, one of her books, one of Juan's books, and one of Yakuta's books are all here. Next to them. I really encourage you to take one home with you. It is so much better than doom scrolling, although we, you know, need to do that sometimes just to make ourselves sane. There's some issues of Freeman's. Sylvia and Adam and David, thank you so much for having this many events over the time. It's been a happiness beyond description. Thank you everyone for coming.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favourite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare & Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.